We are going through a series of the Bible stories from the Old Testament, kind of going through and picking up some of the key stories. Obviously, almost the entire Old Testament is a series of Bible stories, so we can't hit them all, but we're picking key ones. And today, we're looking at the story of David and Goliath, one of the most famous Bible stories. It's one that I'd be surprised if there were people here who hadn't heard this story. It's not a story that is politically correct by today's standards, but for me, growing up as a kid, this was one of the big stories that you told little kids, a story about a big giant who chopped a guy's head off, and, you know, which today, for one thing, they probably couldn't call him a giant. They would have to call him vertically privileged or something like that. But in the political correct world, it doesn't fit. But in that world, in fact, when I was a little kid, and I'm glad we're getting this over today because there's this song that we sang in Sunday school about David and Goliath. And all week, I've had it going through my head over and over again. Last night, seriously, I couldn't sleep because in my head, I'm singing, only a boy named David, only a little sling, only a boy named David, but he could pray and sing. And then it goes, and then he puts a rock in the sling and it goes round and round and round and round and round and round and round. One little stone went up in the air and the giant came tumbling down. And thank you. You can download that on iTunes. But I am sick of that song, seriously. Now, how many of you sang that when you were a kid? Okay, a few. What's with the rest of you? Either you're afraid I'm going to make you sing it, or you grew up pagan or Catholic or something. So, I don't know. But it was a part of maybe my side of the evangelical cult that kind of sang that song. But it is a great story. And so I love looking at it, even though I'll be glad if I can get that song out of my head. So here's what had happened moving up to this. The period of the judges was a dark time. The last judge was Samuel. The children of Israel were insisting on having a king. And so God said, okay, I'll give you a king, and he's going to be the kind of guy that you would pick as a king. So he picked Saul. Saul was tall. He was head and shoulders above everyone else. Really good looking and really dumb, just like all really popular people. And so Saul becomes king, but he was horrible. As a king, he flopped completely. And so God said, next time I'm going to pick one that I would like. And so God sent Samuel to Bethlehem and went to Jesse's house and said, one of his boys are going to be the king. And they brought, he had eight sons altogether. They brought the first seven to Samuel. And he goes, no. And then he goes, there's got to be somebody. Is there somebody else? And they go, well, just the little redheaded squirt who's out, you know, tending sheep. Bring him in here. So they bring David in here. And he goes, this is the guy. And anointed this kid as the next king of Israel. And then left, and David went back to being a shepherd. Well, some time had passed, and we come to chapter 17. David's three oldest brothers are by this time in the military. And so they are out at battle. David's tending sheep back at home. The battle had come to kind of a standstill because the Philistines, who were perennial enemies of Israel, had tried to march across Israel and make a division. If they could make it all the way across the middle of Israel, they could divide the country in two and begin working their way north and south from there. But they had got to a valley called the Elah Valley. And if you've been to Israel with us, you've seen that. We always go there and throw some rocks. But in this valley, you have the Philistines, who their territory is the Gaza Strip. They're in South Israel on the Mediterranean coast, a place that the so-called Palestinians claim is theirs now. But they had marched across, and they're on a hill on one side. The Jews are on a hill on the other side, and there's a valley in the middle. Now, when you come to a valley, it's kind of tricky. How do you fight a war when you're both going downhill, crashing at the middle? So they were having little skirmishes and stuff, but the battle's not really going anywhere. David's dad, Jesse, sent him out with snacks for the soldiers. So he came and brought wine and cheese. No, he brought cheese and bread and flour to his brothers. While he got there, this giant had shown up from the Philistines. And the giant was challenging Israel. Now look in chapter 17, beginning with verse 4. It says, and a champion. Now that word literally is a middleman. And this was a tradition that they had where somebody could, instead of having both countries killing each other, they would just have like an MMA match in the middle. You send your best guy, we'll send our best guy, we'll have a fight, and then whoever loses will back off. So this middleman went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath. He was from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, experts disagree as exactly how tall that was, but generally a cubit is the distance from your elbow to your middle finger, which usually would be around 18 inches, and the span was your thumb to your little finger spread across, so that's usually 6 to 8 inches. So this guy was like maybe 9.5 feet tall. Some people's estimates run a little less than that, some a little more. Anyway, he was a big guy. And he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, one of those heavy metal suits, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, about, I don't know, 120 or so pounds of brass. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, it was like a 4x4. And the iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, or like 17 pounds. And he had a shield bearer that went and walked ahead of him. And then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. So David shows up, and this giant is doing his thing. Now, who's going to go up against a guy who's like 9'6"? The tallest Jew was Saul. It says he was head and shoulders taller than everyone else. So Saul's maybe, you know, 6'2", or no, he's probably 6'8", or whatever. But Goliath towers over him. So Goliath is just saying, come on, send one guy. And everybody's looking at Saul, and he's like, don't look at me. I mean, I got king stuff I have to do. Well, David comes on the scene in this chapter, and David just goes, isn't somebody going to take this guy on? He is saying bad things about our God. Somebody ought to do something. And here's this little pipsqueak kid of a shepherd. And he's saying this, and then somebody goes, well, if you would do it, there is a reward. And David's like, really? What's the reward? He said, well, they'll give you a whole pile of money. He'll make you rich. He'll give you a princess to marry, and you'll be tax-free for the rest of your life. And as a young shepherd, I don't know if he cared that much about taxes or even money, but the idea of marrying a princess sounded pretty good. So David kept going from person to person going, okay, you tell me, what is it that Saul will give if I can beat this guy? And they go, you get a pile of money, you get a princess, and you get no taxes. And so after he asked several people, his brother said to him, shut up. You know, you idiot, you can't do this. You're so arrogant. You think because, somebody came and anointed you and said you're king, you're still a shepherd. Why don't you go back to the sheep? You're making a fool of yourself. But the word had traveled that somebody was asking about the reward, so Saul sent for David. David comes before Saul, and he goes, so I hear you're asking about taking on the giant. And he goes, yeah. And Saul looks at him, and he goes, or maybe David goes, yeah, because he's a little guy. And so Saul goes, you don't have a chance against him, man. You're just a kid. He is a trained soldier. He's been doing this for years. This won't work. And David goes, look, I've killed lions. I've killed bears. I can kill him. I can do this. Somebody's got to stand up for this guy because he's trash-talking God. And so Saul goes, well, okay, if you want to do it. Shows how they couldn't find anyone better than a little shepherd in order to do it, but at least he's willing to do it. So Saul says, okay, here, wear my armor. Now, Saul's a big guy. So David puts on his armor and he can't even budge in it. They put it all on him and he's just like, it doesn't quite fit. I can't move. And so David goes, besides, I'll do it without the armor. It'll be okay. It's fine. So Saul says, okay, man. And David's like, now, one more thing. I get money and your daughter and no taxes, right? Yep, no problem. So he takes off. Now, everyone knew that this kind of a battle involved two people going head to head. They would climb into the ring. I mean, nobody with a spear with a 17-foot head and a shaft like a 4x4 is going to hit you from very far away. It all had to come close. But David comes out there, and all he has is a little sling, and he has a pouch for rocks and a walking stick, and he walks down to this brook, and he picks out 5 nice round stones, puts them in his bag. And everybody's like, what is going on? And he starts moving toward Goliath. When Goliath sees him, he's like, all he sees is David with a stick. He's like, seriously, you're going to fight me with your walking stick? And if you look there in chapter 17 and beginning with verse 12, it says, and when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. So Goliath does his best to sound intimidating. You should be intimidating if you're that big and you have that big armor on and everything. But he's still like doing the best he can to trash talk. But Goliath cannot trash talk like David. David's a poet. David puts words together all the time. He wrote most of the Psalms. So look what David comes up with. You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the field, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. That's a pretty good line. And Goliath said, same with you, but more of it. You know, he doesn't know how to respond to that, but here's this kid, and now he's like, I'm going to have to kill this guy. As soon as he gets close enough, I'm taking him out. Now, again, usually their battles were close. Now, Malcolm Gladwell, in his book on David and Goliath, did some research and suggested that there was a genetic disorder of the pituitary gland still in existence today that causes someone to just continue to grow. And unless you do something medication-wise or surgery-wise to stop it, people will grow to be 10 feet or so. Historically, there are a lot of them who that's happened. But he said that may have been Goliath. But Gladwell points out also, though, that when that happens, one of the first things to go is your vision, because everything's being stretched as you grow, and so quite often these guys couldn't see very well. And Gladwell says, that's why he says, you come to me with sticks. David only had one stick, but maybe he looked at him and saw two. But it also, though, when people have that disease, because their head grows so fast, their skull, especially in the front where there's growth plates and stuff, there's actually a very tender soft spot right there on the forehead, which came in handy for a guy throwing rocks. The other thing about a sling, you got to understand, this was not Dennis the Menace's little slingshot. A sling had a leather pouch with 2 leather thongs coming from it, and you'd put a rock, or sometimes they would use a ball of metal and put it in it, and they would just spin it around. And there's an Israeli ballistics expert who talked about the way they would do it. You'd spin it about 6 times per second. So it was like going around. And he said that people would kill an animal from 200 yards with one of those things. This is a powerful weapon. They estimated that the velocity of that thing was like 100, 120 feet per second. a lot less than a handgun or certainly less than a rifle. But it's like having, you know, when you're on the freeway where there's a 65 mile an hour speed limit and you're driving like 80, imagine a rock coming at you that fast, like 75, 80 miles an hour. Pretty hard to get out of the way of that thing. And that's what they could do. They said that there were people who could hit a coin from as far away as you could see a coin. And over in the book of Judges, it says that their slingers could hit within a hair's breadth. So this is a weapon that's really dangerous. The thing is, and there were other people in Israel who could use a sling, certainly. But nobody ever thought of doing it in a duel with a champion, with a middleman, because that's just not the way we do it. But it's kind of like David coming with this sling. There's an old saying that says, never bring a knife to a gunfight. In other words, don't come in underpowered. And so Goliath there with his big old spear and his guy holding a shield, and he's got all this armor. He can hardly move, but oh, he's intimidating. And then it's like you're going into a ring and you go, okay, anything goes. And they go, anything. It's a fight to the death, a fight to the death. No rules, no rules. And you just pull out a gun from outside the ring and just boom, blow the guy away. That's kind of what this was. No rules, no problem. So he starts running. After he gets his five stones in his bag, he starts swinging this sling and he's running toward Goliath instead of stepping into the ring like a gentleman. And so what happened is, first of all, he wouldn't run straight down the hill. He was probably zigzagging down the hill. So he's hard to see. Goliath's like trying to get his vision. Okay, where is he? I know he's here somewhere. He's still too far away to hit him with his javelin or his spear. So he's just kind of waiting. Next thing he knows, David lets a rock fly, and it hits him right between the eyes on his forehead, and he knocks him unconscious. And then while everybody's just like, I can't believe Goliath is down. I can't believe the kid did that. Then he runs up and takes Goliath's spear, stabs him and kills him, cuts his head off. It's kind of funny that we think of that as a kid's story. And then he takes this honking head and he holds it up like, woo, you know, and then he goes back and gives it to Saul going, okay, can I have my princess now? So, I mean, and then the Philistines were so stunned, the Jews just went nuts and went and slaughtered them and kicked them out of that whole area of the country. So it's a cool story. I mean, you got to love it as a story. It's really good. A few things I want to call your attention to about this story, and then let's talk about how it might have something to do with us. Okay, first thing I notice is David had incredible courage. His faith meant that he was brave. He would try something. Nobody else in Israel is trying it at all, but David would because he had courage. Secondly, David, he believed in God and he wanted to defend God's honor, but he asked repeatedly, what happens to the guy that does this? And so what that tells us is David, besides being courageous, he's also thinking about, if I win, what will happen? What would life be like with a headless giant there? What would life be like to be married to a princess? That didn't turn out so well. Saul's daughter Michelle was a real, you know, problem for him. But that's what he's thinking. This could be cool. Having money, no taxes. And so that's the second thing I noticed. Third thing is, he knows his enemy. David understands, this guy is this way, and I know where he's going to be. He is not moving. I'm mobile, he's not. And I know what he's expecting, so I know how to address it. I know how to confront it because I understand my enemy. And then fourthly, David did not just give in to the way things usually happen. He didn't do what they would habitually do. Most people would understand. What we always do, the way we always do it is, they put a guy up, we put a guy up, they fight in the middle, and then whoever loses backs off and gives up the territory and says, okay, we're your servants. We'll bow down to you. And so, but David, like, tried something different. Again, there were other slingers in Israel. Nobody ever thought about going to a, you know, one of these matches with a slingshot. I don't know why, but it was just, they were such creatures of habit. But David said, I don't care what they usually do. I'm not usually here. I'm not even a soldier. I'm a shepherd. So I'm going to do what shepherds do. And I'm going to get this done. And so we see that he didn't give in to the habits of the way normal people would do things. The fifth thing I see about David is he used the skills that he had. He took his strength and used that. He wasn't good with a spear. He wasn't good when he's loaded down with armor. That wasn't his thing. But running, zigzagging back and forth, and whipping a rock, he was good at that because he's a shepherd. He's sitting out in the wilderness all day long, and after he writes a few psalms, it's like, what else do you do? So he's dinking around with a sling until he gets really good at it. And it came in handy when a lion or bear, somebody would come to try to steal one of his sheep. It gave him practice killing animals. So that's what he did. He did what David does, and that was smart. He also, sixthly, he had a backup plan. Now, maybe you didn't notice, but it says that when he went to the brook, he picked 5 stones out and put them in his bag. Now, you might go, why did he do that? The first one was all it took. If he had faith, why didn't he just use 1 stone? Now, there are people who speculate that, well, Goliath had 4 brothers and whatever. But to me, the way I think probably is David certainly threw the first stone with the intent of doing damage. But if he didn't hit with the first stone, he got 4 more shots. And not only that, there's no way Goliath is going to catch him. He could be running around Goliath's legs and he's just, you know, and he's so slow and so immobile. So David thought, if this doesn't work, I'm going to take the other angle and I'm going to whip another one at him. And I'm going to go whip another one. If I'm out of stones, I can go grab other stones. I can just run away. He can't catch me. I can run back to the Israelis and go, well, now you try. I tried. So David went in with a plan, but he had a backup. He had a few backup plans, no doubt, that he was thinking about. And then seventh, he had an incredible amount of confidence because he had faith in God. He believed that God could do anything. And so he just thought, this is going to work. And even if he was doubting it in his mind, he wasn't going to show that to anyone else. So for all the world who saw him, it was like, he actually thinks he can do this. You have to admire that as well. Okay? So let's get personal. What does this have to do with us? Most of us haven't been challenged to a death match lately, but most of us have giants in our lives. A giant is something that you think you can't conquer it. It is continuing to taunt you. It's affecting the way you live. It's taking your freedom away from you. It's intimidating you. It's making you feel small. Giants are like that. So, for example, for some people, they get a habit and it becomes a giant in their life. It seems like I just can't kick this habit. I try and I try and I try and it just doesn't work. I feel like I'm doing pretty good and then there's that habit. It's there. For other people, there are things that people said to us when we were kids that questioned our value or that questioned whether we would ever be successful, that questioned our intelligence, our worth. And those voices continue to echo in the back of our minds. And they're like a giant. Because no matter what we accomplish, no matter how hard we try, no matter how hard we avoid, we can't seem to live down those giants. For some of us, it was a relationship that went wrong. Maybe an ex-spouse or somebody that you used to love or somebody who was your best friend. And it's like the hurt of that, you know, disgrace, the hurt of being rejected, the hurt of being cut off. It just is a constant reminder to you that you are someone who wasn't valuable enough for somebody to want to do what they had to do in order to have a relationship with you. And that hurts. And that's a giant. It's like, it's there all the time. No matter what you do, no matter what you think, there it is. It's affecting you. For some of you, there are people in your life right now who abuse you and put you down. And you just feel like, I know it. I can feel it coming. It hurts me whenever I see this person. But here it comes again. And it's a giant in your life. It's something that is taunting you. It's something that is holding you back. Maybe for some of you, it's somebody you work with, somebody you work for, that's just making your life miserable. And yet they also make you feel like most abusive people. They make you think you can't do any better, so you stay in a bad situation because they make you feel like that's what you deserve. Now, it's like people who are in an abusive marriage. They stay because an abuser makes you feel like this is what you deserve, this is your fault. So that's a giant. That's something that's like, I'm never going to get over this. This is defining me. This is making me who I am. Whatever failure, whatever incapacity, whatever it is in your life, that is making you feel like you are held back. It's like mocking you from the side. That's your giant. And there are lots of them. And I could sit here and list them forever. But if you think about what you're afraid of, if you think about what demoralizes you, if you think about what happens when you feel discouraged, if you think about what's been your excuse for not doing some of the things you would like to do, you will begin to discover your giants. And just like David faced a giant, we have giants in our lives too. So what do we do about it? First of all, like David, are you willing to take courageous action based on faith? Now, it's easy to criticize what other people do. Like with David, He's going to go out there and fight the giant. Everybody thought he was an idiot for doing that. His brother's like, you're so stupid, go back home. Saul is telling him, you kidding me? He's a trained soldier and you're a little kid. Nobody thought it was smart. This made me think of sometimes when there are people who try to do things for God that I think are dumb. It's so easy to criticize what someone else is doing. So like, for instance, if I see somebody on the street corner preaching in a megaphone, to me, I just feel like, would you just shut up? This is embarrassing for other Christians. This isn't going to work. Nobody's going to get saved from your ranting about the law and sin and, you know, calling people out and all. That's not going to work. But then I ask myself, so what am I doing? Telling people about Jesus in a really safe place where nobody's going to start shouting me down? If they do, the ushers will drag them out. I mean, it's like people who make, Christians who make movies. Every Christian movie I see looks stupid to me. I think, you gotta be kidding me. And the best Christian movies are ones that people go, yeah, it wasn't bad for a Christian movie. But when have I tried to make a movie? What am I trying to do? At some point, we have to say, I give props to somebody who's trying. Because there's something to be said for courage, even if courage makes you try something stupid. Every once in a while, trying something dumb actually works. I think sometimes God sees us trying dumb things and he goes, that's dumb, but okay, I'll bail you out. This will work this time. So we need to look at our giants and say, what am I even trying that shows some modicum of courage and conviction? Am I going for it really, or have I surrendered a long time ago and I'm not doing anything? The second thing that David did is he investigated what the rewards would be. When it comes to the giants in our lives, do we even think about what life would be like if we could defeat them? If I'm living my life completely enslaved to the ideas that somebody else put in my head about me, am I even thinking, what would it be like to be free? What would it be like if those voices that haunt me don't haunt me anymore? That I see them for what they are? What would life feel like if I could have victory over that giant or this giant? If I'm trapped by an addiction, to begin to think, what would it be like to wake up in the morning and not crave something that I know that's hurting me? What would it be like to not subject myself to more abusive treatment from people because I'm free of that? What would that be like? David had the courage to envision what could be. And it was his biggest motivation. He was motivated definitely by, you're an uncircumcised Philistine who's insulting God. But what he kept asking about was, how much will they give you? and a princess? See, and I think sometimes we think that somehow it's wrong to even think about that. But David did, and it really was a powerful motivation. And I think sometimes we have to ask ourselves, with the way we live our lives half chained up and locked up and restricted and afraid of this and worried about that, what would it be like? One of the first steps, what would it feel like to not be like that? To not be afraid anymore? To not believe the lies anymore? And that's something that we need to do, whatever our giants are. Then the third thing David did was he knew his enemy. So do we really understand the giants that are attacking us? Do we really understand what this is about? See, most of the time, if I identify giants, they're people. I think my battle is against people. But Paul says in Ephesians, we don't battle against flesh and blood. But there's principalities and powers that we're doing that really are where our battle lies. Then over in 2 Corinthians 10, he says, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, they're not material, but they're mighty to the tearing down of strongholds. And then he says, taking every thought captive. Do you know where every battle that you'll ever face, every giant you'll ever be harassed by, they all attack you the same place? And it's right up here. It's in your head. Your enemy, whether you know it or not, the devil is your enemy. And the only way he will generally attack you is by lying to you. He gets in your head. And you know this, people, some of them are very manipulative. They say things to you to get in your head. They say things to you to make you believe something, and as long as you believe it, it actually controls you and it determines what you're doing. So when we understand, I get my enemy. My enemy is all about what's going on in here. Paul talks about, you know, to be, have your mind renewed. There's a word that's used a lot in the New Testament, and it's repent. And the word repent in Greek literally means think again. Think differently. So for every battle we face, for every giant that haunts us, it's all going on up here. It's all happening in the head. We need to understand that, because if you don't know your enemy, then you're not going to know how to defeat your enemy. Because our enemies always act bigger than they are. Our enemy is like a little man behind a curtain pretending to be a wizard. So now with David, what he did was, he took unique tactics. Like I said, he didn't do what everyone expected. He didn't just habitually act the way everyone had always acted. And so I have to ask you about your giants. What kind of tactics are you using? If you keep using and trying the same tactics, like you go, yeah, I have this memory of somebody who really said some hurtful things to me. So what are you doing about that? I try not to think about it. Good luck. Try not to think of a pink elephant right now. It's not that easy. See, somehow we have to find a different way to attack, because habit is one of the greatest traps to our lives. Habit robs us of all creativity. David was creative. A lot of people knew how to use a sling. Nobody ever thought about going on one of these MMA matches against a giant with a sling. It's like, wow, no rules, huh? Great. But he thought outside the box. The study of habits is really interesting. I could go on and on about it, but it starts here. Do you understand that, according to neuroscientists, what you see when you're anywhere where you can see, your eyes are only seeing about 40% of what's there. And everything else that you think you see, your brain creates. It's why if something changes, you don't know if it changes. Because like when an animation is created, the background kind of stays the same. You change a few details and it looks like a new picture. Our brains work that way. If I'm in this sanctuary, I don't see everything that's here because I've seen it before and I'm comfortable with it. You come to church every week, you're used to seeing me up here. Unless I do something different or unusual, it's pretty easy for you to just sit there and you're not noticing the musical instruments, the lighting. We can change. Sometimes there are times when we painted And nobody even noticed. Maybe 2 or 3 people noticed. Because it's like, no, my brain already filled in. It looks just like it always did. The people around me, I don't notice who's there because they're always just faces in the crowd. That's how habits are formed. You know how, if you want to understand how ADD feels, think about, like, last night I was at LAX. And I've been through that airport so many times. I'm walking through the airport. I could do it in my sleep. Get to the baggage, get out the door. So I'm not noticing people, things, anything. I'm just walking through. Just like when I drive home at night or drive home after church. I just go home. I don't need, all of a sudden, I'm in my garage. How did that happen? Because I'm so programmed through habit of doing that. So when I walk through a familiar airport, I don't notice anything. Now, go to an airport, say in Asia, that you've never been to. The first time I went to the airport in Hong Kong, it's like, whoa, what is this? This is freaking out. You feel like the room's spinning and everything is just like sensory overload. That's how an ADD person feels like all the time. Because they're sitting here in church and they're just going, oh, Dave's talking, and I'm sure if he says anything decent, you know, people will laugh, and then I can ask the person next to me, what did he say? And I'll get the gist of it, or maybe I'll buy the CD or whatever. But an ADD person has noticed, well, there's 2 guitars up there. Why does Anson have 2 guitars? And over there, was that light? What's that light? Is that new? Is that, there's a stain in the carpet. And I wonder how many chairs are in each row and how many lights are on the ceiling. And look at it, whoa, out the window. And if you're here first service, you see the casino vans driving by on the street. And you're, well, that's what a person is like who is ADD, which for me is a huge advantage. They know more than what those of us who just allow our brains to function can know. Have I totally lost you? Are you with me? Okay. So here's what happens. Because our brains work that way, we are most comfortable doing what we've always done. And for most of us, we live our lives in like slow motion autopilot. So it's like, oh, here it goes, and here's my meal, and here's my bed, and here's my... And sometimes the day is over, and you go, I don't even notice the day. What'd you do today? I don't know. I was up. I was doing stuff. Went to work. Creativity is when you take what is programmed, you take what is habitual, and you go, I'm going to step out of this. I read a fascinating book by the guy that is the CEO of Pixar, who did Toy Story and all those great animated movies. And his book is all about creativity. And one of the points that he makes is, in order to be creative, you have to break those patterns. You have to break out of those habits. You have to be able to remove yourself enough to say, let me look at this differently. Now, that's what it's like to get a sling and to go into a fight with a guy that's all heavily armored and to beat him because nobody else thought about doing it differently. Nobody else thought tactically. Everyone just thought habitually. And so David does that. So back to our giants. What have you tried against your giants that's different? You know what doesn't work? It's what you've been doing. Einstein supposedly said, if you keep doing the same thing and expect different results, you're crazy. Now, in attacking my giants, am I still doing the same things? If so, what I need to do is, like David, put a little zigzag to it. Think about another approach, a different way. So, for instance, if I am just going, oh, it's so hard for me to not eat too much, but I really need to stop eating so bad. So, you know, I start a new diet, and I do it. I'm doing great. At breakfast, I'm just like, yep, I ate really healthy. And then at lunch, I had some gross vegetable salad sort of thing, and yeah, man, it feels good. I mean, I feel better already. And at dinner, it's like salad. Oh, man, it'll feel so good because this is a big victory. And I eat the salad, and then I'm like, man, you know what sounds good right now? A piece of pie with some ice cream on it. Well, if you keep doing that, that just doesn't work. So you have to find some different approach. You have to try something else. If there are people in your life who treat you badly and who put you down, you can keep arguing with them. How's that working for you? you can keep going away and crying and telling yourself, I know it's not right, but deep inside I'm afraid it is. And I really, how about trying another approach? How many different angles can you think of? How about running in a zigzag pattern and trying some different weapons? You see this in warfare all the time. You have to adapt tactically and do something that's unexpected. It's the same thing in physical fighting. If you just keep doing what you always do, eventually somebody figures it out. I remember there was a guy, Chuck Liddell, who was a great fighter in the UFC. But Liddell always, what he did is he would back up when somebody would advance. He would get him stretched out and he would counterpunch. And he had just a great over-the-top looping counterpunch. And if you would chase Liddell, he would beat you. But after a while, people figured out. First, they thought he was unbeatable. Then people figured out, I'm not going to chase him. And they stopped. And Liddell stopped winning. But so many of us in our lives, we just keep trying the same stuff. Sometimes it's even about having the same friends, where being with these people always makes me feel lousy, but it's a habit, so I do it. How can we shake up the way we're living? How can we bring some creativity to the occasion? How can we find some tactics that may work? Most of us have discovered very well what doesn't work against our giants. Now let's think a little bit about what else might work, and let's try something different. That's what David did here. And then, like David, we need to think about, what do I do well? I don't want to get into a contest with somebody doing something I don't do well. If there's somebody who has a sharper wit or a quicker mind or more meanness in them, I don't want to get in an argument with them if I'm always thinking of what to say a day later. There's going to be something else I do better. For David, he had spent hours and hours and hours learning to shoot a sling. So that's his strength at that point. I mean, the only thing that perhaps he could have done better is to have American Idol sing-off with Goliath, because he was good at music, but there's really no way to... I mean, you can destroy someone musically, but it takes a lot longer. And so all it was the sling. What do you do well? What is it that you're gifted at? I'm amazed sometimes how the enemy attacks people and they don't stop to think, what do I do well? How might that be something that will counter the attacks of the enemy that are lying to me, that are getting in my head and making me feel like I'm not worth anything, I don't have anything to offer? God wants to redeem everything that we do well. And so you figure that out. That's what he did. Sling would work good in this occasion because I'm good with a sling. I'm not good with a sword and a spear and a bunch of chain mail on me. I don't run well with that, so I'm going to do what I do well. I run, I shoot. That's what I'm doing. And so we need to look at our lives and say, what is it that I'm good at? Now, if you look at your life and you go, I'm not good at anything, maybe it's time to get some training and some practice. Do something. There are people who, it's amazing to me, but they felt all their lives that I feel like a loser because I never really went to school. I got, dropped out of high school, or I barely graduated, and then I had to go to work. And I know a lady who goes to our church who just felt that way. Her daughters were going through college, and she was just like, it's the one regret I have. And I said, why don't you go for it? Why don't you go now? It sounded like just a huge thing, but she enrolled in Saddleback, and then she ended up at UCI, and then she graduated from UCLA, and now she's in a master's program looking at doctorates. And she's somebody, I think she's younger than me, I'll give her some credit, but not a whole lot. She looks way older than I. No, I'm just kidding. She's away at school, but she listens, so got to be careful. But she had to get creative. Nowadays, there are so many ways to get an education. There are classes online for free. You can go online and learn about anything. And if you need a degree, there's distance learning and everything else. There are a lot of ways to do it. So if you have always felt like, I just feel like nothing because I haven't done this, do it. If you've always felt bad about not playing a musical instrument, learn to play one. Make that a priority. Try something and develop a skill that you can go, this is something that I could actually do. And it doesn't matter that you can do it better than anyone. It just matters that you've devoted enough time to something that you're proficient at it. And so that's an approach we need to take. David, he knew he did music really well and he could fire a sling really well. So he decided, that's the tactic I'm going to use against my enemy. And he did it, and obviously it was very successful. The sixth thing he did, though, is he carried four extra stones. And I think that the lesson for us there is, there's an expression, don't put your eggs in one basket. It's not that bad to put your eggs in one basket, but don't put everything into one egg. You know, he had a backup plan. Yeah, he fully intended that first rock to do its job. And he threw it hard, and he was good at it, and he expected the giant to drop. But he had four other rocks. And he's like, you know, he was thinking, if he manages to dodge that one or I nick it off his helmet, I'm just going to loop back around the other way and I'm going to hit him from that angle. And he's so slow, he's not even going to be able to turn. And this guy with this big heavy shield isn't going to be able to protect him. I have four shots at him. And then I'm going to run. Let's see him catch me with all that armor on, a big lumbering guy. I got all kinds of options. I can run back to Israel and go, at least I tried. Now who's going to go next? You know, tag out somebody and have them go and do it. So David didn't just go, This is it. It's all or nothing. Instead, he goes, I think this will work. I believe it. But I got some backup plans. This isn't the end of the world for me if my first rock doesn't hit him. And for us in our lives, do we just decide, I'm going to do this and this is it? I remember when I was running for eighth grade president. And by the way, I never ran for president. I thought, you know, nobody cool would do that. Plus, I wouldn't have won. I was too mean to too many people. But, you know, you may have this trauma from running for ASB president in eighth grade and you lost. And it's just been haunting you. So you decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run for the president of the United States. And that'll kill that giant. Nobody will be laughing at me anymore. Okay, if that's what you want to do, we couldn't do worse. But the thing is, what if that doesn't work? Do you have another plan? Is there something else that might be effective? That's the kind of flexibility they had. But finally, what we see in David was that ultimately he had confidence. He had confidence because he believed in God. He had confidence because he knew he had a good plan, some good tactics. He knew he had some skills, believed God was on his side to help him. But again, he did it. He didn't just toss a rock up in the air and go, okay, God, make it hit him. No, he did what he was called to do, and he believed that God would pull it off and would bring it on. And so he had that confidence. And I think sometimes even if we fake it at first, if we believe in God, we know that his Holy Spirit lives inside of us, we know that he loves us, then I think we can try some stuff with the intent of it working, feeling like right now I am going for this. Because here's the deal. You try to do anything in your life without confidence, you will fail almost every time. Now, again, you're realistic. If I don't do this, I have another plan. But I think this is going to work. I'm going for it. I'm going to achieve the results that I ultimately would want to achieve. And so that's kind of what I take away from David and Goliath, from this story. It makes me want to think about, what are my giants? What is still taunting me? What am I still afraid of? What is it that I haven't done that I had a feeling I should have? And why? I want to understand it. I want to try to, take a look at it with courage. I want to imagine what it would be like if I could do that. I want to understand that the enemy is in my head, that I need to get take my thoughts captive in order to win that. I want to not function in terms of habit. I want to try something different. I want to try something unique if I can come up with it. I'm going to spend some time thinking about something I haven't tried yet that I can try, come up with a few plans. At the same time, I'm going to use what it is that I have that I do well. I want to ultimately keep having backup plans, but I want to believe, I want to be confident that I have God on my side, there is every reason to believe this can win. There's every reason to believe that he can inspire the crazy stuff I might want to try, or at the very least, he'll feel so sorry for me, he'll make it work just to bail me out. And to me, that's the lesson here. So for you, I would challenge you to ask yourself, what are your giants? What is it that's holding you back? What is it that's mocking you and taunting you? What memory, what idea, what feeling, what hurt, what betrayal, whatever it is, what is it that's just like looming? Tackle it. Think about what it would be like if that wasn't there. Take a courageous step. Try something different. Develop skills that can be useful. Ultimately, have confidence that God is able to do what he can do. Have a backup plan, but go for it. Try something courageous this week, something you haven't yet tried. And if you do that, when you get to heaven, David will go, I saw that. That's pretty cool. You know, I got the idea from you, little guy. That was amazing what you did. And it made me think maybe I could do it too. Now, if you're here today and you've never really even, basically your whole life is your giant. You look at your life and it's become overwhelming. There's nothing in it that's going right. You've never really experienced any kind of meaningful success. You have very little hope for the future. Well, chances are, maybe you've never even actually given your life to Jesus Christ. Maybe the giant that you have is the giant of sin, that like sin is controlling your head. You believe lies constantly. You keep doing things that are destroying you. And if you've never actually accepted Jesus Christ, then this may be the first big step. That's the giant that can die now, is your sin. All you have to do is believe that Jesus Christ died for you. He rose again from the dead so that you could defeat sin in your life, so that you could be forgiven and clean before him, so that you don't have to carry all the lies and the burdens anymore because he took them on himself. And if you've never entered into that relationship with him, do it today. After the service, there'll be people down here who would just love to pray for you and lead you into a relationship with Jesus. That's your giant. And he's already been defeated. All you have to do is give Jesus permission to give you that victory. So if you don't know him, come down and do that. If you know him, but you're realizing, man, there's some stuff that's just really kicking my tail, back up a little bit. Decide that you're not going to accept those results. Think about what your life would be like if you can have victory. And then get creative. Step outside what you habitually do. Do something different. And see what kind of tactics God can give you in order to win a victory that you can celebrate. And you'll share with him. He wants you to do that. He wants you to learn to do that. If you just keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. But if you can try a little different approach, be amazed what your life can be. And I pray that this week God will be speaking to you and helping you to do just that. Let's pray. God, we're sorry when we let habit paint the picture and we just go through the motions. The enemy is attacking us in our heads. He's getting into our heads. He's intimidating us. He's hurting us. He's using people to do it, but ultimately, we're the ones who decide whether we are going to accept that or not. And we get so used to being victims, and we get so used to putting ourselves down, that we do to ourselves what other people have tried to do to us. Help us to get the victory through you. Help us to rise up out of courage. Help us to approach things differently, come up with new tactics. Help us to live our lives with our eyes wide open, considering all the options, developing our skills, and seeing what you do, and we'll give you all the glory. So help us. And for the people here who don't know you, I pray that they will understand. As complicated as this has kind of been today with the story, if it's new to them, yet, Lord, I pray that what they will understand is they can drop a giant today. They can have their sins forgiven. So just appeal to them within their hearts. Help them to know nothing today is more important than coming down and getting right with you. And I pray that they will do just that. We thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand. As always.